This is side two of tape number 406, September 14th, 1979. Carpus was found dead. There were sleeping pills next to the bed. The Spanish newspapers said his death didn't appear to be natural causes, but they also refused, the Spanish judicial authorities refused to give any results of the autopsy that was performed. You'd think people would be getting suspicious about organs removed, autopsies locked up, and so forth, but these type of things go on, and the masses or the public just doesn't seem to care or get away with it because nobody seems to care. The various obituaries or articles about Carpus didn't bother to mention his association with Charles Manson, although they did mention that he was up in Washington. There was an article in a magazine section of the newspaper that really had nothing to do with Carpus's death. It's called The Living Death of Charles Manson by Roger Rappaport, September, just this last week, in which the article says, in quotes, Charles Manson likes to play his guitar for prisoners when he's feeling better. Alvin Carpus, one of the Ma Barker gang, taught him the instrument at the Washington Penitentiary. It was the guitar that led Sue Atkins, this is the woman later who turned out to be the government agent, she first became infatuated with Charles Manson through this guitar. He handed me the guitar, and I thought, this is Carpus giving Charles Manson the guitar. I can't play this, and Carpus said, you can play it if you want to. It blew my mind because he was inside my head, and I knew he was something that I had been looking for, and I went down and kissed his feet, Charles Manson kissing Alvin Creepy Carpus's feet. In the book The Family by Ed Saunders, that came out in 1971, published by E.P. Dutton, it tells the background of Charles Manson, the father of this girl that he was going with, an insurance agent, came out from the East and was furious because he thought Manson was pimping and taking beaver shots of his daughter, and Manson was out on forging a check. Not a very serious crime these days when you think of what's going on, and a bond was set for $10,000, and the man asked that his parole be revoked, and he was sent to McNeil Island Penitentiary, and that's where Manson, because of his father interfering and having his parole revoked, he was sent up to McNeil Penitentiary, and it was up there that he met Creepy Carpus. In the book, The Family, Ed Sanders said this was the year of the liberation movement. We've gone through assassinations, Vietnam, sexual liberation, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, and Hare Krishna. And it was the time at McNeil Island that Manson began to study magic and warlockery and hypnotism and astral projection, Masonic lore, Scientology, ego games, subliminal motivation, music, and Rosicrucianism. Now, Ed Sanders, if he'd ever visited any federal penitentiary, would know it'd be impossible. Almost impossible to get any book of any of this kind into there, because during this whole period I was corresponding with people in prisons, and it's very hard to get this information out. He goes on to say that Charles Manson had what they called the headphone capers. He used the prison radio system and used post-hypnotic suggestion for all the prisoners at McNeil Island Penitentiary. Manson set up a clandestine scheme on the radio station through the headphones, and he'd plant suggestions, telling them to applause for him at a talent show when he played his guitar. Manson was a protege in prison of Prohibition gangster Alvin Carpus, a member of the evil Ma Banker Barker gang that left 14 victims dead. Alvin, old Creepy Carpus, taught Charlie to play the steel guitar and was a general counselor to the young man. And although he was interviewed after Manson's arrest, Carpus said he considered Manson the last man on earth to go into mass murder business. Charlie was hooked on this new thing called Scientology. Now, it's interesting that Manson could get these Scientology books into prison because the Scientologists have been so violently anti-Nazi and anti-Hitler, and yet Charles Manson was to be used as a provocateur agent against the hippies and the anti-war protesters later. So also through the seven murders plus the baby in Sharon Tate, they could link these murders to a group which they called the Cult of Scientology that was going about exposing Adolf Hitler. Manson learned Scientology from Lanier, Raymer, Dayton, and Jerry Millman, his roommate at McNeil Island. Raymer was a doctor of Scientology, and Manson told a jailhouse visitor that he received 150 sessions of processing in jail. Now, I met a man who was a guard at McNeil Island that told me that when Manson was with Alvin Creepy Karpus and he had a guitar, no other person in prison was allowed such favors and such guitars, and that he was singled out to be with this person who later, Alvin, in exchange, got out of the penitentiaries in 69, was sent to Canada and then to Spain to live in exchange for helping set up Charles Manson with his music training and his contacts, and he met them. He also picked up Scientology phrases later when he got out. Manson, I'm reading from the book The Family, studied Masonic lore, picked up a knowledge, and gave Masonic hand signals that he would flash to the judge during his court appearance. He also had books by Dr. Eric Byrne on transactional analysis, games people play. He had a friend, Marvin White, who appears to have been released from McNeil Island and made arrangements to mail Charlie books on black magic and related subjects and books on telepathic, power-hungry people and cults and so forth. Alvin Karpus of the Barker Gang remembers that he was constant telling people he would come on like the Beatles if he ever got the chance. He asked me to fix him up with high-powered men like Frankie Carbo and David Beck and anyone that would book him in the big time. And after 5 years at McNeil Island, several friends of Manson's talked about legal maneuvers by which Charlie got transferred from McNeil Island to Terminal Island and San Pedro, and then shortly he was released, and he had contacts and cards to go to Universal Studios, recording studios, and so forth. Charles Watson, who did all the murders of the Manson that Manson was charged with, the ones at Sharon Tate's house and the LaBianca family the next night, has said that he will get out of prison soon. He was married just last week to a woman who's helping him get out of prison, and he said he has contacts from organized crime. Of course, the book The Family tells how Manson goes up to Berkeley, to the University of California Berkeley campus with his guitar, and meets Mary Bruner and Abigail Folger from the Folger Coffee Company, and then to the Haight Ashbury, and as a federal parolee, he was getting all kinds of favors and entertained at beaches and was even offered a job in Canada to sing. And the book The Family tells about the transition of Charles Manson, but the transition began in the cell of Alvin Creepy Karpus. Those are the contacts of the drugs, the organized crime, the Canadian contacts, tax for later to set up, and this was an agent provocateur action in the 60s to come down on the hippies and to blame them for violence because they were so predominantly anti-establishment and particularly anti-war. And John Mitchell, the Attorney General, and the government in Washington were using the memos of Adolf Hitler on how to handle the radicals and youth. And Alvin Creepy Karp is now again buried without any information of medical reasons on how he died. Could have been another agent provocateur released in 69 after he did his job with Charlie, was sent to Canada, then Spain, and he just died without, again, any proof that he wasn't murdered, like William Sullivan or George de Morenchild or any other important person to the whole 60s. I keep promising about background on the rock music, the hippies, and the anti-war movement, and I'll stop making promises and do it maybe in a few weeks. But in an article I did write for We, which they paid me and didn't publish, I had a section called The Battleground of what was happening in America in 1968 and 69. And that's the time when Karpus is out of jail and Manson's on the streets and all hell is to break loose, particularly in California, the first para-fascist state. CIA Director Richard Helms had warned National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger in February 18, 1969, that their study that they had on, quote, restless youth was extremely sensitive. It could prove very embarrassing to anybody who got a hold of it, and particularly since this was modeled after Adolf Hitler's Reichstag. And according to the memo, for all concerned, if word got out, the CIA might be involved in domestic matters. The FBI had sent out a list of suggestions to all their agencies and the police on their stated goals, and the suggestions are published April 26, 1976 in the Senate Intelligence Book study with respect to intelligence activities and human rights of Americans. Some of the suggestions put into the Senate report were gather information on their immorality. These are the youth. Show them Aesculapius and depraved. These are also the black movements, the women's movement, the anti-war protesters, the United Prisoners Union. There are a list of so-called enemies. Call attention to their habits and living conditions. Explore every possible embarrassment. Send in women and sex and break up marriages. Have members arrested on marijuana charges. Investigate any personal conflicts and animosities between them. Send articles to newspapers showing their depravity. Use narcotics and free sex to entrap. Use misinformation to confuse and disrupt. Get records on their bank accounts. Get specimens of their handwriting. Provoke target groups into rivalry that may result in death. That is Henry Kissinger, Nazi Kissinger, and Richard Helms, and the FBI moving into action. And this was their activities in February 69. By the summer of 69, we had the Altamont concert. That followed Woodstock, which was the peaceful hippie meeting of musicians and young people to do their thing. And right after that, because it was so successful, Altamont followed. The attorney for Altamont with the Rolling Stones was Melvin Belli, who was Jack Ruby's attorney, to cover up the role that Ruby played in killing Lee Harvey Oswald. The group selected for the cover up the killings and the violence was to be the Rolling Stones. The bodyguards were the Hell's Angels, working for the drug enforcement agencies and the Treasury Department. And just this last week, speaking of agent provocateurs, I received a copy of an ABC News program, which I'm not going to repeat the whole thing to you because you can send for it. We won't use our time and tapes, our valuable time and tapes, for this, but send for, I'm giving you the address of ABC News in case you didn't see it, and the address is here. There was a program called 2020, this last July 19th, asking how did he get in the White House, and there's a gentleman there, an ex-con who deals in drugs and gun running, who was an agent for the Justice Department, who was an informer for the Drug Enforcement Agency. He goes by the name, in the hippie movement, he went by the name of John James, and recently his name is John Ellsworth. He's 33-year-old, described as a 330-pound high school dropout, involved in money laundering, and he set up a front called the ICA, the International Children's Appeal. It's a clearinghouse for weapons and drugs, and in 1977 he was with Amy Carter and Rosalind Carter setting up a White House Christmas show, and then he used those pictures to set up his International Children's Appeal, which is a front for gun running and narcotics and bilking the public out of millions. He had been arrested. His trouble started in 1968, which is 1 year before the Altamont concert, and he was released very quickly out of jail. He had been charged with bad checks and a dozen of other charges, forgery, grand larceny, and similar to other agent provocateurs, in exchange for dropping their prison charges, they do favors. This guy was out on the road using the name John James. He was with the Rolling Stones, and according to the 2020 program, the investigation of ABC News, he helped set up the infamous concert at Altamont, California, in which a security force of Hell's Angels stabbed to death a young spectator. They didn't say in the script that the young spectator's name was Meredith and that he was a black man and that he was filmed being murdered on camera at the time that the Rolling Stones were singing a song about John Kennedy for the association of John Kennedy with this murder. And Ellsworth, the 2020 show, said, appeared on camera. He was right in the scene of Gimme Shelter. All this was the CIA Kissinger Helms Reichstag to end all anti-war hippie movements because the rock festivals were getting too many, up to 500,000 youth protesting and leaving home and leaving the establishment. And this was the Reichstag way of ending the folk festivals once and for all and breaking up the groups so that eventually all music is done through Ticketron, Bass Outlet, and the days of Monterey Pop and Woodstock were to be over forever. There was a music festival here in Monterey last weekend on Saturday and Sunday, and I bought tickets for both days to go with friends, sit out in the sun, and a organization called Tribal Stomp hoped that maybe they could bring back something of Monterey Pop. They'd been trying for 3 years to get a concert here, and you can't bring back the 60s. It isn't there, and there were drugs and police and the whole event was so bad that after Saturday night, I didn't even return Sunday and use the tickets. It was $25 just for the day, and I wouldn't even go back into the place. Saturday night, there was a woman going around handing out acid and asking people. She came up to us, "Do you want some acid?" And, of course, anyone who's doing that at rock festivals, I'm really very suspicious of the consequences of these things. And later that evening, coincidentally or not, and maybe had nothing to do with it, one young woman who was at the concert with her young daughter went down the road just several hundred feet where there was a bridge over a freeway, and she jumped over there and died, commit suicide, allegedly. Whether it was acid or drugs or really despondent, we don't know. But again, a death was linked, probable stomp was associated in the newspaper with the death of this woman, and the 60s will never come back. And the whole feeling was set up by these agents. This John Ellsworth is an acknowledged federal informant. He has maintained close contact with two federal law enforcement agencies. According to the ABC program, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the administration, the Justice Department. Of course, the question is, how did he get to Rosalynn Carter? How did he get into the White House with Amy and Rosalynn Carter, their Christmas program, and use their names and pictures? This family, the Carters, have been set up with all kinds of characters like that. But the interesting thing is, not only has he been mentioned as being involved in possible hashish running, a huge multi-million dollar scam that they're investigating in New Jersey, a $50 million boatload of hash off of New Jersey. He possibly is linked with that the federal agency is investigating him with. But the point is that he was at Aldemont. He was with the team, and that was a provocateur situation set up for a purpose, and it was as final to the whole youth movement, that event that I have followed closely, as the Reichstag was in Germany. Jean Seberg, the actress, died September 11, 1979. She just died. And the story for her death right on the front page is FBI blamed for actress suicide. Her husband, ex-husband Romain Gary, a well-known author and diplomat, blamed the FBI. He said at one time they planted false stories that she was pregnant and that they planted stories that the father was a Black Panther leader and activist. She had been active in the 60s, Jean Seberg, helping black causes, and she was 7 months pregnant. And at the shock of this, and the spreading of these rumors by the FBI, which they found out that they did and were instrumental in getting her divorce proceedings going, she became despondent and the baby aborted. And according to her husband, who's a very reputable ex-husband, I keep saying husband, reputable and reliable writer, if you've read any of the books of Romain Gary and I have, he said that after the experiences of what the FBI did, she became psychotic and evidently never recovered and left a note for her living son and wanted to die. Her mind never came back, and she was one of the victims of the FBI investigation to break up her marriage, plant stories just like they have in the Senate Report COINTEL program. And Jean Seberg died this week, but very few people reading the story of her suicide or the FBI causing can really understand the insidious disease of Hoover and Hitler, their co-related fascism, the FBI and the Gestapo, and how many lives they've turned around and tortured until people finally are forced to kill themselves. And I really call these suicides murder. These unfinished agent provocateur cases appear and will overappear in the news for the next 100 years until they're solved. David Berkowitz still makes the news. September the 4th, 1979, New York Post. He's telling about his experiences in killing six people. When he was interviewed again this last week, he said he never knew who the victims would be, that Sam gives me the word to shoot, and I would shoot. Sam Carr was his neighbor. He was writing letters to Jimmy Breslin talking about John Wheat Carr, and he seemed to know John Wheat Carr. Well, David Berkowitz was a Gentile child adopted by Jewish parents, confused about his religion, sent to South Korea, was anti-war, had normal girlfriends and normal feelings, put into an army hospital, comes home, works for the federal government at the post office, and has this double personality, and does these mass killings in New York that take so much attention, like the Zodiac killings and the Manson killings or the SLA kidnapping and the various provocateur activities that increase our federal government bureaucracy but serve no other purpose. At the time of the killings, that David Berkowitz was writing to Jimmy Breslin about a John Wheat car. Well, John Wheat car was found dead in February of 1978. Another story, a self-inflicted gunshot, similar, I guess, to William Sullivan of the FBI or George de Morenschild or Carlos Prio Siqueiros. He was the son of the Sam car that Berkowitz said was giving him the orders to shoot. He was found at a U.S. Air Force base in North Dakota, and he had referred, David Berkowitz had referred to John Wheaties as being the rapist and the suffocator of young girls. Well, John Wheat Carr was the person who was found dead in 1978, and Sam Carr, the father, was his neighbor. Now, who was giving orders? Was the son actually doing the murders, like Jack the Ripper, the grandson of Queen Victoria? And Berkowitz was taking the orders from the father who was covering for the son's murders. We'll never know. Sam Carr's daughter, whose name is Wheat, also worked for the Yonkers Police Department, and she played a role when David Berkowitz was finally discovered and led the police to David Berkowitz. Now, this poor son of Sam Carr was at this Army base. He had been there 3 days before his death, and there was no evidence of his being unhappy or depressed. He had been discharged from the Air Force base in October of 75, and for some reason or other, he was up there, and he was killed, and he was a psychology student also at the Air Force base, and he lived there and had studied psychology. So how many people were involved in the New York killings? How much mind control was used? How much anti-Semitism in Berkowitz, the Jew, Jewish name, killing Jewish families, and so forth? How many games and experiments are done on mind control, and why is Berkowitz in the news now talking about Sam giving the orders? Because the cases will never be solved, and people will always be interested in them until we get the whole truth. I know you all saw the sleazy hotel where David Kennedy was obtaining his drug connections. They referred to him as White James, and he'd pull up in a $15,000 BMW, and everyone knew he was getting his drug connections. The police said they knew it. One article in the New York News, September 1979, reprinted in our San Jose Mercury, said that David Kennedy was very bitter since his father died, that, in quotes, he's never forgiven the world for taking away his dad, end quote. Sure, he's bitter. You see articles the week before on Sirhan and the possibility that Sirhan didn't get off more than one or two shots. There's movies out, such as The Second Gun, which he could have seen at one time or another. There's books questioning how his father was killed. There's a new one out by Bill Turner. His mother conceals the crimes. She either has to raise the children, who are now adults, and one is getting treatment now for heroin and dope that he evidently has been on for a long time and dropped out of school. She either has to raise the kids by saying, A, there was no conspiracy, your father was killed by Sirhan, or B, I don't know who did it and I don't care and you shut up, and once a year we'll have a tennis tournament to memorialize your father, and other than that, you go out in the world and you don't know who was the killer. Just good luck and go your way, all you kids, the 10 kids of Ethel and Carolyn and John and all the others. Don't talk about assassinations. Just reap the harvest, mind your own business. And yet these kids, college age, this boy going to Boston University, I'm sure he turns on one station up there. There are plenty of them that talks about the assassinations and the conspiracies. And his subconscious must be riddled not only with bitterness that the world took his father, the world didn't take his father. An organization hires a man at Lockheed named Thane Caesar, and a Grant Cooper defends Sirhan and railroads him, or a Dr. Diamond hypnotizes Sirhan to say he killed that man. I wish that he'd get off drugs and figure it out for himself. And the Kennedy kids must be more than confused and more than bitter. And I'm sure they have to be as bitter at their family as they are at the world, because the problem is solvable and their family is sitting on it expecting them to live normal lives. How can they live normal lives with killers at large that their own parents don't even want to know about? That family must really be a mess when it gets together trying to play their little games and swimming at Hyannisport and pretending all this isn't going on, when all the time there's information and the House Select Committee on Assassinations now coming out and saying there was a conspiracy that killed John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. I'm sure David Kennedy must be wondering why his father wasn't included in that investigation. But what's he going to do? He may as well shoot himself in the arms and take his dope and sniff his coke, because that's his only out. And once they cure him of the drug disease, he has to still live with the problem, which is almost worse than taking the drug. William Burney died this last week, September the 1st, 1979. He was a journalism major. He was a senior editor of Reader's Digest. He went, graduated in 1931 from Williams College and went to Germany, to Bonn and Munich, just at the time that Hitler, 2 years before Hitler was getting into power. He was studying in Germany just at the time the Nazi Party was getting control, and already Mein Kampf was out and distributed, and the path for the future of Germany was pretty clear. He was a writer in the United States that went back to Germany in 1957 to 1960 as chief of information for the United States Embassy, which is an intelligence job in West Germany, till 1960. In 1960, Robert Mayhew was meeting with the assassination teams. That's where we go back to those chronologies that are so important. And Senator Kennedy won the nomination for the presidency of the United States and won the election. And at Reader's Digest was William Burney, A.H. Burney, senior editor, who retired in 1967 before the Robert Kennedy assassination, but after the John Kennedy and through those years of the Kennedy assassination. Now, George Seldes, in his newspapers, in fact, they were going on many years before the Kennedy assassination, was writing in the 1940s and up through 1945 on the Reader's Digest being a organization that propagandizes the United States anti-labor, anti-Semitic, anti-Negro, filled with prejudice. He accused the Reader's Digest of being used by the National Association of Manufacturers for advertising, for disseminating information through radio, advertising of fascism. Seldes accused them of printing as early as July 1943 anti-Soviet material, an article by Max Eastman, "Must We Face the Facts? Why We Must Face the Facts About Russia." There was an I Hate Russia group. Remember, in March 1943 and in May 43, the Hitler group began to go underground, and in July, the Reader's Digest, 2 years before the war was over, was printing anti-Russian material when the Soviets were our allies. The Reader's Digest has used people like Edward Epstein. They published his book, he attacks the Warren Commission critics. They hire Poinsettia Pierce, the woman who called the police when Nelson Rockefeller died in New York. She works for Reader's Digest. Alex Haley, who published Roots and who praised the Mormon genealogy, has worked with Reader's Digest and has covered up the Malcolm X assassination. He was a friend of Malcolm's and wrote and has done nothing to help solve the Malcolm X murder. The Reader's Digest has been a conduit for put downs and praise ups, depending which side you're on, right or left. And I think it's interesting, when you read the obituaries of these people, I don't believe William Burney was murdered at all. He died in a nice old age, and presumably from natural causes. But the chronology of the staff of Reader's Digest, from being in Munich and Bonn up to the Hitler period, going back in intelligence and then being senior editor with a pro-German slant, gives you a view of how the editorial policies came about and who was working for the Reader's Digest. And it's these pieces of information you pick up when these particular servants for them die. Burney was 69 years old when he died. He had been sick for a year, but his links to Germany and to a publication that made an effort to put down any investigation of the Kennedy assassination and to promote the book Inquest with its phony pro-Russian slant as against investigating the Nazis is interesting. That has been the role consistent. The Henry Luce Time, Life, Fortune chain, and the Reader's Digest have molded the minds of the American students and the media for years. And when you break down how the staff got there, you get a certain picture of how their policies come to be written. One quick death, because time is running out here. Mrs. Slovak died, the widow of Private Slovak, September 3rd, 1979, at the age of 64. She said, according to the newspapers, in quotes, "The Senate Judiciary Committee was waiting for me to die for them to forget this matter. She wanted her husband's name cleared up. He died at a firing squad charged with desertion, and the document showed that General Eisenhower ordered it just to set an example so nobody would desert him at a critical time during the war. The only American soldier since Civil War to be shot for desertion. She died the week before the vote at the judiciary. I haven't heard anything about clearing his name in the news since that time. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel. You take care, and I'll be back with you next week.
So when life was so tender that no one wept except